From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the February 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Focus on Emily Anderson. Even amongst the distinguished ranks of World War II Codebreakers, Emily Anderson stood out. Recruited into military intelligence during World War I, her stellar career in diplomatic codebreaking lasted into the 1950s. Her greatest achievement came with the breaking of high-level Italian ciphers during the East African campaign of 1940-41. It was called the perfect example of the cryptographer's war and earned her an OBE in 1943. Anderson was also a renowned musicologist. Her translations of the letters of Mozart and Beethoven are still considered authoritative. Yet until recent years, her life and intelligence work remained under the radar. This episode helps to set the record straight and kick off a new occasional series focusing on the key personalities in codebreaking and intelligence. Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, is joined by Jackie Ichona from the University of Galway to discuss the subject of her 2023 biography, Queen of Codes, The Secret Life of Emily Anderson, Britain's greatest female codebreaker. Our thanks go to Sarah Langston for voicing our historical documents.
Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. It's always lovely to come to Bletchley.
Brilliant. I want to start off by asking you, who is Emily Anderson and why should we care about her?
Actually, I would have asked myself that question 6 years ago before I started writing her biography, because I knew very little about her. And what I knew about her was only maybe a third of the actual story. How I came across her first was that she was the first professor of German at the university where I teach, the University of Galway in the west of Ireland. And she was appointed to that position in 1917. So the war had already started at that point, but she took up the position of professor of German, the first professor of German and the first woman professor of German in the university. So far, so good. She then takes leave of absence during the rest of the war. She comes back in 1919 and does a little bit of teaching, but she's going backwards and forwards to London. And nobody really questioned that. I suppose they thought she was doing research. And I also knew that she was a famous musicologist, that she'd actually translated the letters of Beethoven and Mozart from German into English and had won an award for doing that. But I actually discovered that there was way more to her than that, purely by accident, which is an amazing thing, I suppose. And then I spent 5 years of my life researching her life then.
How did you come across her? You found a letter, you said?
Yeah, it was strange. I was working on another book. I'm a biographer primarily, so I'm not an intelligence historian. I never set out to be. I'm a biographer. I like telling the story of people's lives. And I was working on the tail end of a previous biography I was writing and working on the records in my own university. And in a file, tucked into a little side pouch of this file, I found a resignation letter from Emily Anderson, and it was dated 1917, basically. And she was saying, I'm resigning my post. I've been recruited to work in the Foreign Office in London. And I assumed that's, you know, so far so good. She's a linguist, foreign languages, Foreign Office.
Well, that makes sense, right?
It makes
the cover,
total
the cover
sense.
Held.
Exactly.
For a time.
But then there was another letter tucked in. And this one was not written to the governing body of the university, the formal letter. This was to her friend, who was the college registrar, who happened to be a priest. He was her confidant. And she says to him in that letter, actually, the real story is I've been recruited to military intelligence work. I'm to be sent to London, trained, and then I'm to be sent to France as a code breaker. And I looked at this letter and I thought, what? What is this all about? Nobody knows anything about this. Military intelligence. So that sort of sparked a curiosity in me. And I thought, I better try to find out a bit more about this woman. And then subsequently discovered, of course, that she'd got the OBE in 1943. So we're talking 1917, she resigns. 1943, she gets the OBE for military intelligence work in the Middle East. So there's definitely a trail here to be followed. And that trail led me to the National Archives at Kew. And I started working through the records and, to my astonishment, discovered that this woman who had been recruited to codebreaking in 1917 had served through the rest of the First World War, had served in the interwar period and had then served in the Second World War with great distinction, winning the OBE, as I mentioned, in 1943 when the war was still happening, and didn't retire until 1950. And yet everybody assumed at home in Ireland and presumably here in the UK too, that she had been working for, in inverted commas, the Foreign Office. And it was only when I started reaching out to intelligence historians who knew on the ground what was happening, they said, oh gosh, yeah, Emily Anderson. She was the best of the lot of them. She was the best of the women code breakers. And she kept completely below the radar, which suited her. And that was when I decided I have to write this woman's biography. So that's what I did.
Fantastic. So why do you think she was so under the radar for so long?
I think it suited her purposes, actually, because of what I mentioned earlier on, her interest in musicology. There's a concert hall named after her in my university. There is an Emily Anderson concert every year. There's a prize in the Royal Philharmonic Society, a violin prize sponsored by her through her will. So she was very much involved in that world of musicology and respected as a musicologist. And my belief, and certainly my research tended to bear this out, was that the only way she could have done what she did, researching German letters of German composers in Germany, traveling to places like Berlin, Cologne, Vienna, after the First World War, before the Second World War, and after the Second World War as well, she couldn't have done that if any of those German agencies had suspected for one second that she'd actually been listening in on coded messages for nearly 40 years. It's quite an extraordinary thing. So she chose to keep that side of her life private. Her professional life, which she'd also taken the Official Secrets Act, of course, so obviously she wasn't allowed to speak about it. But I think to do the thing that gave her the most pleasure, and she said this very often, her real work started when she left here. When she
left, says that to Denniston, doesn't she?
She actually did say that. She had an argument with Denniston at one point. And she said, Commander, you don't seem to realise that my real work starts when I leave here. So she left as the most senior female codebreaker in Italian diplomatic section, as it turned out, not German, left here and went back to her flat in Hampstead, probably had a very simple dinner, and then started into this extraordinary task of translating the entire archive of Beethoven, as she did after the Second World War, and Mozart leading up to it. She only published her letters of Mozart in 1938, just before the war began. And she picked up then with Beethoven afterwards and kept working on those till 1961, when she published the letters of Beethoven to international acclaim. But to come back to your question, I think the only way she could have done that, travelled internationally as a musicologist, the lovely person, Miss Anderson of the Foreign Office, that was perfectly acceptable. She works in diplomacy. She's a linguist. Of course she does. Codebreaker? Not at all. This woman couldn't possibly be a codebreaker. But that life was only possible when nobody knew what her real career was as the top female codebreaker that she was.
So can we go back to the beginning? Where does Anderson come from? What's her early life like? How does that lead her towards this high-flying codebreaking career?
Well, she begins her life in Galway in the west of Ireland, where I currently teach. And she was born to the professor of physics at the university, a man called Alexander Anderson, a very famous physicist, actually. He was famous for being the first person to describe the possibility of black holes well in advance of anybody else. So he's a very eminent physicist who studied at Sydney, Sussex and Cambridge and knew the professor of mathematics there was his best friend, etc. He was from Coleraine in County Derry, or Londonderry as it was then. So an Ulster Presbyterian, very much dyed in the wool Ulster Presbyterian, very much a unionist background, very much, you know, keeping Ireland within the empire. And Anderson was the second of his four children, and they were all born in Galway. Born and raised in the quadrangle, actually, of the university. So they live and grow up in this kind of cloistered environment, for want of a better word. Highly academic family, you know, expectations were high that these would be well educated. And in a way, the fact that they were all Presbyterian in a predominantly Catholic Galway meant that they didn't go to school locally. They were actually educated by governesses within the college quadrangle. So it's a very insular life. They only had each other to play with. They became very self-sufficient. and very insular in that respect. And I think in a way that really had an impact on Emily down through her life. You know, she was capable of just shutting herself down and not revealing too much about herself because she lived in such a cloistered environment. But she was a very precocious child, very clever, particularly if, with an affinity for languages. They were schooled by a succession of Swiss-German governesses, would you believe? Which was actually rather clever of her parents because she got two for the price of one. She got German and she got French from her Swiss-German governesses. And they became proficient in both languages. And the only other release that she had, I suppose, because she didn't really have friends other than her siblings, was her piano. She was a magnificent pianist and she played piano all her life and music became the real passion of her life. It enabled her to escape into another world and I think sustained her throughout her life. She studied for a degree in modern languages at what was then Queen's College Galway, or then became the University of Galway. Her father became president of the university and she took a first class honours degree with distinction. The examiners wanted the words "with distinction" put on her first class honours degree because they said her answering was of quite exceptional merit. So she is a serious, serious linguist, treats above everybody else. And so a career in academia really beckoned for her. When she finishes her degree, she goes to Germany to hone her skills in 1912, 1913. She's in the University of Berlin. She's in the University of Marburg, postgraduate studies. And then 1914 happens. And of course, she has to get out of Germany very, very quickly and does so, comes back to Galway. There's not much work for her to do in the university. So she's offered a job in Barbados, of all places, as a languages mistress, as it turned out. And off she takes the ship to Barbados in 1915, stays there until 1917, where she comes back to Galway to take up the position of a professor of German because the previous professor had died. That's how she sort of arrives back in Galway in 1917. And it's at that point that her whole life changes completely because the need for code breakers has increased enormously. And they want people who can translate very quickly, who have a proficiency for that. And when you look back on everything I've told you about her so far, she's a very skilled linguist and a very prolific speaker of the language, not just studying it academically. She's fluent in both French and German. And has a very decent level of Italian.
And she's probably got that non-academic understanding of the language that we often hear is quite the colloquial.
Precisely. And I think that was a huge bonus. You're absolutely right. She's a linguist. She's the daughter of a physicist and mathematician. So she's got that maths brain going on. And thirdly, she's a musician. So she's used to reading patterns and repetitions. Yes. So if you were to design a code breaker, you'd design Emily Anderson, really, you know? And I think probably when she was recruited, that had jumped out at whoever it was made the first approach. And we're not sure exactly who made the first approach. I suspect it was through her father's connection with the professor of maths in Cambridge, or indeed the professor of languages in Queen's College in Belfast, who was a man called Professor Savory, who was already working in MI1B, the Military Intelligence Bureau. And that's where Anderson eventually ended up. So it's networks of people who know the right people.
We often talk about that in World War II, but obviously it all happened before the first time around.
Precisely. Yeah. So that's when I think she was approached. And she says in the letter, that famous letter that I said that I found by pure accident in a file, she said, "They have asked me to help. And as I have the skills to do so, I feel I am obliged to do so. I will stay for the duration of war and then return to my academic job in Galway." That was the plan, but that's not how it panned out.
Do you think she saw it as a patriotic obligation or something interesting, something that would get her away from Galway when she was maybe a little bit kicking her feet?
You're absolutely on the money there. A lot of it was to do with the fact that, as I said, in 1917, she came back to Galway. Just before that, at the tail end of 1916, her brother Alexander, her one and only brother, who joined the Royal Flying Corps as soon as the war began, he was straight in. He was in the latter stages of his degree and he left to enlist in the British Army. And it turned out he ended up in the Air Force. But in December of 1916, he was what's called an observer, not the pilot, but he's the observer. He's the guy who stands out of the cockpit and takes these photographs, aerial photographs, from an open cockpit of a plane, balancing himself in the cockpit. I mean...
And it's one of these FE2Bs, isn't it? With
yes.
the sort of cockpit right out in front.
Absolutely.
Like a turret.
Yeah.
And he's leaning...
Leaning out. No, no safety harness, nothing, you
no
know.
No parachutes.
But in 1916, him and his pilot were shot down over the Somme. They're shot down by German forces. His pilot is killed. So Anderson gets the plane down onto the ground and lands it successfully. He himself is injured, but he's captured by the Germans. He spends the rest of the war in prisoner of war camp for officers in Germany. So his family back in Galway get the word in December 1916, Alexander is a prisoner of war. And I think that probably played a part in Anderson deciding to come home, because her parents clearly would have been traumatized by that. And as it happened, the German professor had died at the time. So it's partially, you know, in respect to her parents, but also I think she wanted to be closer to home because her brother's now missing in action. Well, not missing in action in the sense that he's dead, but they don't know where exactly which prisoner of war camp he's in, but they know he's been held prisoner somewhere. And it's around that time that the first unofficial approach is made to her. Would she be prepared to use her skills as a code breaker? And she says in that letter, which is very interesting, she makes reference to the fact that I'm to be sent to France. There are a few other women have been asked to go. They're all university lecturers. And since I have the skills, I have been asked to go. And really what was being talked about there were the hushwacks, the famous hushwacks of the First World War, who were basically members of the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps who specialised in code breaking. But their work was so secret that they were known as the Hush, because it was hush, hush. And they were trained and they were actually sent to France, and they were in Saint-Omer. They were very close to the front, dangerous posting. But she was very willing to do that. She was willing to be trained and sent over there. And they were there for a number of years doing very difficult work in difficult environment. But by the time she's recruited and trained, the Second Battle of the Marne has happened and the Americans are in the war and the war is looking like it's going to turn. It's not as pressing for there to be people on the ground in France anymore. But by then they trained her up. They'd seen not just that she was really good at code breaking, but that she was spectacularly good. And so she's asked to stay on and work in military intelligence, the first iteration of it, MI1B. And that's what she does. She goes to work for MI1B and is spectacularly successful.
She's at Cork Street, is that right?
Yes, she's at Cork Street.
Working for Malcolm Hay.
Yes. And she seems to have got on well with Hay. I mean, I looked at the archive of Malcolm Hay in Aberdeen, the University of Aberdeen. And there's this beautiful book, the Cork Street book, which is a lovely album that was put together when they all went their separate ways at the end of the war. And she has a beautiful poem in it translated from French, which is very complimentary to Hay. And not everybody got on with Hay, but she seems to have got on with him. But it's an amazing piece, this Cork Street book, and all these people who really believed that this man was a terrific leader and led them to break so many codes during the First World War. So she's in Cork Street, does extremely well. And at the end of the war, they basically realised that there was going to be a need to keep this cohort of very skilled code breakers together, and ideally to do it interagency. So you'd have the army, the navy and the military all combined, sort of combined agency for code breaking. Anderson is one of four women who are asked to stay on basically and give their services for the foreseeable future. It was an offshoot of the Foreign Office at that stage. It wasn't a specific entity in itself. So what they were setting up effectively was an interagency code breaking cohort within the Foreign Office. So she's made an offer. She has to decide whether to accept it or go back to her academic work in Galway. She's a professor, you know, so she was on a decent salary. And what made it more difficult for her was that the salaries that she and her fellow female codebreakers were offered were less than half of what their male equivalents were being paid. And this really irked Anderson. She was really, really ticked off at the fact that younger men and less experienced men were being paid more than twice what she was being paid. And she was by far the most able of all of the women, and certainly a lot better than some of the men. So she decided to do something really brave, I think. She decided to keep a foot in both camps. So she won't commit to joining this new code-breaking bureau, basically. She refuses to do that until such time as they will give her parity with men, or at least a better salary. And secondly, that they give her a position that is a tenure track position. So she wants to be a junior assistant that can be promoted to a senior assistant, etc., etc. Basically, she says, this is going to be my career. If it is, I want to be able to be promoted. I want my salary to increase. And the Foreign Office are saying, absolutely no way. We're not doing this. This is not happening. It's never been done. It's not going to be done. And you're not going to be the first. So she says, OK, I'm not going to commit to doing this. And of course, panic stations generate, because everybody knew, Denniston knows, that she is by far and away the best of the female codebreakers. Oh, they absolutely need her. But she plays it cool and she really fights her corner. And eventually they do increase the salary significantly. And she's the best paid of the lot. But she's also the first woman appointed to the position of junior assistant in the British Civil Service as a whole, not just the Foreign Office. And that's significant because women didn't get appointed to those positions. They're women. They're going to get married. They're going to go up and have children. Why would we invest in them and their careers? They won't have a career. But for Anderson, this was her career. She was never going to marry or have children. So she wanted this position and she fought for it and she got it in the
end.
She's
an absolute trailblazer in that respect.
Absolutely.
On top of everything else. What does her work during the interwar period look like?
Luckily for her, her priority and her specialism had always been diplomatic intelligence, or Diplo, as it's known for short, in the trade. So she was listening in on the messages that were coming from embassies, from politicians, from senior people within the diplomatic service, etc. It's a special kind of intelligence. It's not like military intelligence, which would basically be about troop movements and battle plans and all of that sort of stuff. And it's a lot more clear cut, I suppose, in many respects. Not that it's easy, but it's more clear cut. Whereas when you're dealing with Diplo, you're dealing with guys who, generally speaking, have, you know, been exposed to a lot of different cultures, music, philosophy, art, literature, you name it, and will bring those references into their Diplo. And so you have to be subtly able to pick references out and know what they mean in order to basically...
You have to understand the background context of the messages you're reading.
The context is the word I was looking for.
You can't just be a codebreaker. You have to be a foreign policy expert in a way.
Precisely.
You have to understand international diplomacy.
Yeah.
She must have been abreast of all of this. She must have been very well informed.
And because she was so well travelled, of course, she got all those nuances, the references to music, the references to poetry. You know, Goethe pops up in a Diplo message and she knows straight away what that reference is. So she had a specialism that was really needed in the interwar period. And what always strikes me as very interesting is that although her preferred language was German, she actually was an expert in Italian Diplo, because they didn't have enough people who actually were able to translate messages in Italian. She made a very brave decision, which was, okay, I'll step into that breach, but I'll need to bump up on my Italian. Which she does by taking on a monumental task in the 1920s, where she decides she's going to translate Benedetto Croce, an Italian writer's translation of the life of Goethe from German to Italian into English. So she's doing this kind of three-way translation, which is extraordinary, off her own bat, completely off her own bat, in her own time at home, and really improves her Italian as a result of that. And then publishes the book.
But you can still find this book, can't you? You can still buy this.
Oh, yeah.
Without Emily Anderson's name on the cover.
It doesn't. That's the funny thing. It doesn't. Like, at that point, she didn't want anybody to know what she was at. So there's a tiny reference in the book to the fact that this translation is by Miss Emily Anderson of the Foreign Office. But, you know, it's not on the cover. If you're going looking for it, you won't find it. I have it. I've managed to get a copy of it. And I just thought, gosh, you clever thing. You know, you're even hiding in plain sight, even at that stage. But that is why the longevity of her career, I think, is so striking. It's because her specialism was in Diplo. That meant even when it wasn't a time of war, her skills listening in were actually required the whole time. And when it came to the Second World War, she was able to then position herself very easily and, when necessary, to move into military intelligence, which is what she did eventually in Cairo.
She's a specialist in a particular type of code, isn't she? She doesn't do machine ciphers. She never does machine ciphers.
No, she never does machine ciphers, never. No.
She's what we refer to as a book builder.
Yes, indeed.
So she works on super enciphered codes. So you have a code book. You use your code book to turn your message into a set of numbers. And then you have a separate table which you use to super encipher those numbers. And that means as long as you change the table every so often, you can keep using the code book for a long time. That's right. So it's a completely different style of code breaking from what we're normally familiar with, thinking about what HUT 6 and HUT 8 do at Bletchley Park.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you have these two specialisms, don't you? You have book breaking and book building.
Yes, yeah.
And I have struggled to find a good explanation of what either of these jobs actually involves, because it's so difficult to define, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you and me both, Tom. I struggle to figure it out. Remember, I'm not a code breaking expert. I'm a biographer who happened to be writing a biography of a code breaker. But what I did come across repeatedly, and you will have done the same in the records, is, you know, that she's considered one of the best book builders there is. So she can break them, but she can also build these code books. How she does it, I simply don't know. It's an extraordinary skill set. I presume an extraordinary skill set that she required. But what strikes me about her is this ability to just step away and get the long view on things. She had this incredible ability to do that in every aspect of her life, including her musicology. And she managed to hone that skill in a way that I couldn't imagine doing. But there's no question about it. I mean, there's a reference at some point to Alan Turing, for example, being sent off to Dilly Knox to know how to build books, basically. But he's already been with somebody else. And the only other person he could have been with is Emily Anderson, because she was the other book building expert within the organization. So it's, to me, you know, it seems very obvious. We don't have it in writing anywhere. I believe there is a reference at one point to herself and Turing working together when he was recruited.
We know she worked with Josh Cooper, Wilfred Bosworth, I think I'm right in saying. So
They were
wartime
all
high flyers, learned their trade from her.
100%. And actually, they were all junior to her and spoke very highly of her, actually. Bosworth in particular just said that she set a high standard for everybody that worked with her. And she could be difficult. She could be, you know, demanding and, you know, give out to them, basically, you know, criticize them. But he had huge respect for her, as did Josh Cooper's similarly. They had a huge regard for her. But what's fascinating in Josh Cooper's account of working with Miss Anderson, he talks about the fact that he was an expert in Spanish when he was joined. But she said, Italy is a first world power. I need people to work in first world power languages. So I need you in my section. So she poaches him from the Spanish section and she okays that with Denniston. And he said, OK, Emily, that's fine. I'm not going to argue if you need him. And she trained him up and he had enormous regard for her. So, you know, there's no doubt of the fact that this woman had the ear of Denniston on a regular basis. He'd been the one who authorised her being recruited after the First World War.
So Denniston, Room 40 codebreaker, takes over GCNCS.
He takes over as...
In 1919.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So when she does join, it's initially called the Government Code and Cipher School. And he's the head of that. And poor old Malcolm Hay has to step aside. I think it was the right decision. It was 100% the right decision. Because Denniston had the skills to pull this gang of really disparate characters together. But she has Denniston's ear and he's a huge respect for her. He was one of those who fought actually for her to get the higher pay and get the status of a junior assistant. Then immediately she's, you know, promoted to senior assistant.
Your book breakers and your book builders have to look at a message and they have to kind of work out what's going on under the encipherment. But there is a distinction because the book breakers look at it in a more mathematical way, is my understanding. And they look at the code groups of the code book and cross-reference those. You read about people like William F. Clarke. He has a perfect memory for the code groups in a message, however they might look, and can cross-reference them wherever he might see them and reconstruct the text that way. But Emily Anderson's skill is more linguistic, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And it's in perceiving how the grammar of a message will be laid out.
Precisely.
And what word might go where.
Yeah.
And therefore, she fills in the other side of the equation as a book builder.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I mentioned earlier that she was a born codebreaker because of the three things, the linguistics, the maths that she had. She was a very good mathematician and as a musician, she's seeing patterns and repetition when you're reading a piece of music. You know, you're looking for all these dots and quavers.
We often hear about how many skilled composers worked at Bletchley because it's pattern recognition.
And she's looking at this document and she's got this incredible ability to look at the broad and then to zone in on the specific. For example, you know, because she was so good at German, she knew that pretty much every German verb ends in en. And so she's looking at a code and she's saying, where are the verbs likely to be? She sees a QR or a QP or whatever, and in the space where en is likely to be. So she now knows that's the verb. So she's able to zone in from that and work left and right of that, I suppose, in trying to make sense of the message. And that was how it was explained to me by somebody who knows this world. But that made complete sense to me because she could do that zone out and then zone in very closely. And because she was at it so long, she could see it from both perspectives, from the person who's trying to break the code and the person who's trying to make the code. She can see both sides. And that's, I think, what made her such an incredible book builder, as she was, no question about it.
And what I find really fascinating is how much of an overlap there is between that book building work in her day job and her reconstruction or her translation of these letters.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what really, I mean, you know, there were moments in doing this research where I thought, oh my gosh, obviously, that's exactly what was going on here. And one of them was when I went to the Beethoven House in Germany. And I was looking at all the correspondence that Emily Anderson had had with the Beethoven House when she was working on the Beethoven letters. And the archivists were saying, OK, here's some copies of Beethoven's original handwriting, which is almost illegible. In the latter stages of his life, you could barely read it. And we know from her correspondence that there were only 5 people in the world who could read the latter handwriting of Beethoven, and Anderson was one of them. But how she did it was to use the skill set she'd acquired as a code breaker to decode the handwriting of Beethoven. So she's looking, for example, is that the tail on his G or is that the cross on his F? And she's able to figure that out over time. And it took her 12 years of practice of every night going home from her day job. She actually did work on Beethoven letters. There's an account of her sitting at her desk and pulling out her Beethoven work in the middle of all of the war when there was nothing for her to decode. But she goes home and she then is trying to break the code of Beethoven's handwriting. And she does it spectacularly so that she corrects mistakes in translation that other translators had actually missed. Not Emily Anderson. She wasn't going to miss anything. And ultimately, it's an extraordinary interview that she gave in 1961 that really confirms that that's what was going on. Because she just published the letters of Beethoven. Nobody at this stage knows that Miss Anderson of the Foreign Office is a code breaker. But she goes into an interview in the BBC with a music expert who asks her about her letters. And he asks her, how did she approach her translation of the letters in this very difficult handwriting? And she starts to talk about that. And he said, oh, I see, using the originals as a crib. And she starts using cribs and words like that. And there's a bit of backwards and forwards going on. And I listened to that interview for the first time in the British Library. And I thought, hold on a second here. The man who she's speaking to is a guy called Dennis Stevens, who was a musicologist of some note and broadcaster. And it's in the course of that interview that you start to sort of see something resembling, you know, it takes one to know one. Literally, you can hear it in the interview. Because they talk about it must have been difficult for you to translate these letters. And she said, oh, yes, it was. I had to first use the originals as a prompt. And he said, using them as a crib. And she says, oh, yes, there's language being used that's very definitely about code breaking. No question. And when I was listening to it for the first time, I remember thinking, this guy knows what he's talking about. And he knows that the woman sitting opposite him is not Miss Emily Anderson of the Foreign Office, who's in her spare time is this woman who does a little bit of musicology. He knows that she's a code breaker. And he knew that because he himself was. Dennis Stevens had been a code breaker with the RAF working on Japanese codes. So it's this sort of atmosphere you can sense. I would have loved to have been in the room, but the interview is magical to listen to. And for me, it was fantastic. It was the only time, and it will be the only time, that I'll actually get to hear Emily Anderson's voice. So by the time I found the interview, in the British Library, I've been writing the book for 4 years, and then to sit down and hear her talking about her work and the bonus that she's talking cryptically about the Beethoven letters, but really is revealing I'm actually a very, very good code breaker and I use those skills. And Dennis Stevens, a fellow code breaker, recognised that. It's absolutely fantastic to listen to that.
Before looking at Beethoven, Anderson had actually translated Mozart, hadn't she?
Yes.
And my understanding is that was a slightly different process.
It was, but it was sort of a variation on the theme, if you like, because whilst the handwriting of Mozart wasn't as difficult, and some would say impossible, as Beethoven's handwriting was, he and his family wrote cryptically to each other. In fact, they wrote in codes. They actually wrote coded messages to each other. And the reason for that was, I suppose, just of a sense of fun. Mozart was a more gregarious character than Beethoven was, far less serious than Beethoven. But also, he and his family were being watched very carefully by the Bishop of Salzburg, who was trying to keep an eye on them and what they were doing and who they were meeting. So for fun, they started writing coded messages to each other, some of which was quite ribald and a little bit risque, some of the things that they were saying. But they got away with it because the way they wrote was a secret code between him and his siblings and his parents, which really strikes me as hilarious, you know. So there she is, before she ever goes near Beethoven, she's dealing with the coded letters of Mozart, and she breaks them all. She breaks down even mistranslations in previous editions of the Mozart letters. She says, no, that's not what he's saying at all. This is actually what he's saying. And in publishing the Mozart letters, she put all the risque stuff in, which others had
not. She's completely rigorous, isn't she, about all the dirty jokes and the references and the bad language?
Absolutely. I actually think she relished that, to be honest with you. I think it just, she found the task enjoyable. She really enjoyed doing the Mozart letters because it meant in that pre-war period, she was traveling all over Europe whenever she had the time, you know, establishing networks in beautiful places like Salzburg and Vienna. And she had friends who were academics or antiquarians. And there's loads of lovely letters where she talks about her friend here and her friend there. And she's, you know, she's cruising on the Rhine and she's having a wonderful time of it. But when it comes to publishing the letters, which she did for Macmillan, by the way, Macmillan's were her publishers for both the Beethoven and the Mozart letters. She's pretty unequivocal. And she says, no, this is going in. I know people might consider it rude or a little bit risque or whatever, but this is what they said, so I'm not going to edit it out, and I'm going to give you an absolutely bald translation of what they said, and if you're offended, tough, this is what's here, this is what I'm going to present you with. And she did.
She's almost got the same attitude towards a publisher that she has within GCNCS as to,
she in does, terms of, actually.
I need to do this work in the way yeah. that I see fit.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And do you know what? I think that is something that some of her more junior officers who work beneath her, they find that difficult to deal with, you know, because they don't like forthright women who are telling them what to do, basically, you know. So a lot of the junior guys, like Philby, for example, P.W. Philby, makes awful comments about her, you know, being this dothery old woman. And she was in her 50s, you know, she's younger than me at this stage. And he talks about her, you know, being demanding, etc. She was streets ahead of him as a code breaker, absolutely streets ahead of him. And she didn't bother herself with messages. For example, he says something about, you know, she would only deal with messages that were less than 24 hours old. But the reason she did that was because she was faster than everybody else and they were the most important messages to break them. So she did have to deal with younger men who didn't quite respect where she was at and didn't see the incredible sophistication of her code breaking.
And that's pretty typical for the time, that a professional woman who knows her business,
yeah.
If she was male, she would have been looked at much more favourably.
Absolutely.
But when it comes from a woman, she's forthright, she's yes. difficult, she's ferocious, or whatever word you want to apply to it.
Absolutely. Actually, one of the words they use is bully. That's one of the quotes I found in one of the documents. She seemed to bully everyone that worked beneath her. But actually, those who knew her well, as we talked about Josh Cooper, for example, they just say, no, she just wanted the best. She wanted everybody to do their best. And she set the same standards for herself as she set for everybody else. So it must have been difficult to be in that position. But I suspect that the fact that she was significantly senior and had the ear of Denniston, and he knew her measure and knew how important she was, she could just ignore them and go home and do the work that she enjoyed when she was off duty, so to speak, and just put up with a lot of the nonsense when she could. She didn't really have a choice, as you say. It was very much the norm within that world. And particularly, I think, after the Second World War, when the need for code breakers had declined, a lot of women left the service and went back to their ordinary life. Certainly a lot of the women who worked here at Bletchley just said, that's great, my duty's done, I'm going home. But Anderson was a lifer in one sense. You know, she'd been there since 1917. She was staying till she got her pension, which she did in 1950. And then she left and off she goes and she starts really working on her Beethoven letters in earnest. But it's interesting that she picked Mozart and Beethoven. And her friend, who she has a friend who's still alive, living in Germany. And her friend told me that she loved the music of Beethoven. She loved his life. She had a huge affinity with the struggles that he himself had to go through. But that she actually preferred to play Mozart, which is kind of interesting. And there are letters to confirm that. She was working with a lot of people and she would invite them back to her flat in Hampstead. And she would play the piano and they would play the flute or the violin. And she just loved those little exchanges of professional colleagues who were able to play as well. And as you know, Tom, so many of those who worked here at Bletchley were musicians of a very high caliber, be it singers or actual musicians. But it's a common theme amongst codebreakers of that period. So many of them were very, very good musicians. And also, I think, like Anderson, it was the music that sustained them through those difficult times when that intense, pressured work, they could just let off some steam.
So 1939 comes around, GCNCS comes down to Bletchley Park. Anderson's still working in Italian diplomatic.
Yes, she was working in Italian diplo. She was in the second party to move to Bletchley, would you believe, in July of 39. And she arrives to work in Bletchley, but actually she and the rest of the diplo people are the older generation of codebreakers. And they find the life at Bletchley a little bit young and excitable, etc. And too noisy and they can't concentrate. So they move. They actually don't stay on the Bletchley campus. They actually go to an adjacent school, what had been a school called Elmer's, which is within sight or was within sight.
Yeah, just outside the main gate.
Exactly. So that's where the diplo and the commercial people go. So the older, more experienced ones get away from all the young people, but they're within striking distance of the main house as needs be. She's unusual in that she has a car. So she drives down herself from London and she stays in a very prestigious billet. And I think that struck me when I saw the billeting list for Bletchley in July of 39. She arrives and she is staying in the Manor House in Swanbourne, which is a very fancy house, staying with Lord Hayward and his family. And she doesn't stay there very long. She moves to another house nearby. But she's very happy here. I think she really enjoys the focus of the work. Now it's quite intense and she's working with very good people and they really do have something to work on now. And of course, because Italy was very much figuring out where Italy was going, whether they were going to support Hitler or not, was something that she was probably one of the first people to figure out what Mussolini's intentions were. So she was right at the heart of the action, really, and that's why she could ask for additional staff. But it was an extraordinary time in her life. And it turned out to be one of the happiest times in her life, I think. She didn't stay very long. She was only here until July of 1940, at which point she moved to Cairo to CBME, Combined Bureau Middle East.
But before she goes, she makes a big contribution through helping with the recruitment to the organisation, doesn't she?
She does. Purely by accident, actually, as it turns out, because she moved, as I mentioned, from the Manor House. She wasn't happy there and she moves to another house called The Cottage. And that is the home of Sir Charles Bartley and his family. It's a smaller house, but still a nice house. And she moves into that as her billet. And in that house, living there, was a young 20-year-old called Patricia Bartley. And Patricia Bartley had just come down from Oxford with a degree in PPE and is a very good linguist, very good French, very good German. And straight away, no sooner is she in the house, that Anderson twigs, this is a smart lady. This young girl is actually very, very smart. She needs to be recruited. So she actually recruits her to Bletchley. So Patricia's just the daughter of her landlord, effectively. But it turned out that Anderson's instincts were extremely on the money because Patricia Bartley turns out to be an extraordinarily good codebreaker. Rises at the age of 23 to be head of German diplomatic section at Bletchley, which is astonishing in my view, but she deserved every bit of it.
She's somebody we're going to have to profile in her own right at some point, I think, but it's such a good example. probably the best example I can think of about how it takes a codebreaker to know a potential codebreaker.
Correct, exactly. And I did actually interview Patricia Barclay. I was so, so fortunate that I interviewed her when she was 101. And I was the only person, I think, to ever interview her. I don't think anybody else has spoken to her. And she had such extraordinary memories of that time, you know, as a young woman coming to Bletchley and the excitement of it. And she was in the house. She was in the main house, I think, on the opposite side of the front door to Denniston's office. Denniston's office was on the left. I think Patricia's office was on the right of the door, and described all of that to me in great detail. But she was a really good find for Bletchley. And it was Anderson who saw her potential and recommended her to Denniston. She saw out the war, basically, and did extraordinary things. In fact, being absolutely instrumental in breaking Floradora, which was the German diplomatic code, sort of sister code to Enigma, which was the military code. And she and her team broke Floradora, which was considered to be almost unbreakable, but she did it.
It's an incredible feat.
Incredible, at the age of 23, astonishing.
9th of November, 1940. Dear Commander Denniston, Major Jacob tells me that a vaguely fast air route is leaving tomorrow, so I'm taking this opportunity of sending you a few lines about our work. As you will remember, our work in England on AO2, the main line book to which a daily subtractor is applied, came practically to an end in the middle of May, when the Sarafan bags ceased to arrive. When we took up our work out here, there was a fair daily supply of messages in this book, enough to solve the subtractor system, which has turned out to be 272 groups, or 1,360 digits long, and is staggered in eights. That is, the start of a message must fit on the 9th or 17th subtractor group. The subtractor is changed every day and is never repeated, hence the solver must have a reasonable amount of material with which to work. But when Dorothy Brooks had worked out the system, a cry went up for more operational, i.e. internal East Africa messages, and the operators out here were instructed to concentrate on these stations, with the result that the intercepting of the AO2 messages, mainline to Rome, by now practically ceased. The Rome outward material taken in England and wired out to me is quite insufficient for the purpose of solving a daily subtractor. I understand from Major Jacob that once sufficient sets are available and the new operators have been trained, the old arrangement will be restored, when we shall again settle down to AO2. But of course, by that time, the book, which was introduced in April 1939, may have been changed. Meanwhile, we are far from slack, and I have worked up quite an important section, consisting of ourselves and two NCOs, Davis and Peterson, both of whom are doing first-class work. CRs, now reciphered with pair-for-pair figure substitution tables, changing every 3 days, are still going strong, and I circulate any messages which are of interest, operational or general. We are both well, and now that the pleasantly cool weather has come, we feel very fit and energetic. Major Jacob is a most able and sympathetic head of our company, and we are both very happy in our present working conditions. We have not yet heard when we are to be moved to Heliopolis. I hope that you and your family are very well. Please give my most cordial greetings to my friends in the park and the school. With kindest regards from us both, yours sincerely, Emily Anderson.
Can you tell us about how Emily Anderson ended up going out to Cairo?
That in itself is a great story, because she asked to be sent there. And when you think about that, that's quite extraordinary, because she's a very senior codebreaker. She's doing remarkable work here. Why would she want to put her life in danger by going to Cairo? You know, it's front line. There's, you know, a lot of things happening.
Even getting there is
pretty
hazardous.
Getting there logistically was a nightmare, but they did it, and it took them weeks to make it. They literally took a ship from Liverpool and sailed down to the Cape, basically, and made their way by trains, planes and automobiles, literally the whole length of Africa to get to Cairo, because they had to go through territory, some of which was being controlled by the Germans or indeed the Italians. And they did it. It took them 3 weeks. But she asked to be sent. In fact, if you read the messages, she's demanding to be sent. She wants to be close to her traffic so that she can hear what the Italians are saying and what their intentions are.
You've got the Italians have been neutral up to June 1940.
Correct.
They join on the side of the Germans. And up to this point, they'd obviously been listening into the traffic going out to Italian East Africa.
Yes.
Which is going to be the big area where Emily makes a main contribution. And this is all being picked up at the Army Y station in Sarafand in Palestine.
That's right.
and being shipped back to Britain via France. But of course, France falls to the enemy. The Italians control much of the Mediterranean. That traffic dries up.
Correct.
And suddenly you have a problem that these intercepts, if they arrive, are weeks late. And Emily knows enough about the intelligence impact of this to understand this is going to be problematic.
That's exactly right. And so she made a very direct, you know, approach to Denniston and said, I need to be closer to my traffic. I need to get out there. So please send me with another codebreaker who happened to be a woman called Dorothy Brooks. Send us out there so that we can be on the ground and intercepting the traffic and decoding it in real time or as real time as possible. So that's why they undertook that trip. And it wasn't easy. You know, it really wasn't an easy trip to make. They were putting their lives in danger, but they did it. And they were immensely successful in their offices in Cairo, the Combined Bureau Middle East. Now, they did enjoy their time there, it has to be said. It was a little bit of a release from the dreary, dark, wet weather of the UK at that time. And there's a fantastic letter from Denniston to Anderson about that, saying, you know, we're driving through sludge and rain while you look on the pyramids in moonlight. You know, it's a gorgeous letter, very personal letter.
We have quite a few bits of correspondence back and forth, yes, between Egypt and Britain,
yes,
don't we?
Yes, there is. And most of it is very businesslike and very detailed. But occasionally she does sort of let her guard down a little bit and talks about how lovely it is to be here. And there's photographs of her in front of the pyramids and of Dorothy on a camel and all this sort of stuff. So they make the best of their mission, but there's no getting away from the fact that it's a very serious mission. And I think it's very interesting that when they go to Cairo, their billet in Cairo is the British Embassy in Cairo. That's where they're staying. You know, it's a very, very important fact, I think, that they were right at the heart of what was happening in terms of trying to turn the war on its axis and try to win it. And really, at that point in 40 to 43, it's in Cairo and in the Middle East, and certainly in the North and East Africa, that's where it's going to be won or lost.
And it's a really important but really neglected part of, yes, the intelligence war, what happens in East Africa. You've got something like 200,000 Italian troops,
that's right,
out there. Obviously, as soon as Italy joins the war, all the British territories in that area are under threat, and, yes, British Somaliland is quite quickly occupied by the Italians, and then they have to push back. The British focus, you know, forget about North Africa, forget about Greece and the Balkans. It's clearing up the Italians in East Africa.
That's right.
To protect their rear areas. Because, yes, if you have that area under enemy control, then Egypt isn't secure.
Precisely.
And it's a campaign in which intelligence is absolutely vital, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. It was described by General Wavell as the perfect example of the cryptographer's war. That's what he says. He says that in a letter. And he also says it in relation to the fact that it was for that intelligence work that Emily Anderson is awarded the OBE in 1943, when the war is still happening. Most people have to wait for the war to be over before they get their OBEs. She got it in 43 for that intelligence that she provided.
Because you've got Italian authorities in East Africa talking back to Rome and, yes, back and forth, saying, here's the situation, here's how many troops we have, here's all the planes, here's how much fuel we have. All that military information is,
absolutely,
in the diplomatic traffic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And even soldiers and senior officers who didn't believe in the importance of SIGINT 100% changed their opinions after the East Africa campaign. You know, Wavell in particular had not been as big a fan as some officers, but he was 100% blown away by how much real-time knowledge they were getting of the intentions of the Italians. And there is a fantastic film of the surrender of Amba Alaghi, which was the last stand by the Italian forces. It's an amazing piece of footage. And you see the head of the Italian forces, the Duke of Aosta, basically handing himself up to British officers, and is treated with huge respect. Because I think by that stage, the Italians had kind of had enough, really, you know. But as you said, it was a critical, critical pivot point in the war. And it's for that that she gets the OBE and that Dorothy Brooks is awarded the MBE. So they both get awarded honours for their work in the East Africa campaign, deservedly so, in my opinion. In mentioning Dorothy Brooks, I suppose it's only fair to say that they had met at Bletchley on the very first day. Actually, they were in the same group that arrived on the same day at Bletchley Park. And they weren't in the same billet initially, but it's clear from correspondence that they began a relationship, a same-sex relationship, not long after they got here. And it's one of the reasons why Anderson leaves her first billet, is that they're not in favour of her and her partner, you know, spending time together in the house. So they moved to the cottage, which is where they met Patricia Bartley. And Patricia Bartley was able to tell me when I interviewed her, well, yes, they were a couple. There's no question about that. And she talked to me about them going for walks together, playing music together. They were absolutely a couple at that point. And it doesn't surprise me, and it certainly wouldn't have surprised anybody else, that when she moved to Cairo, she wanted Dorothy to come with her. But critically, not because Dorothy was her partner in a romantic relationship, because she was also a fantastic codebreaker.
Yes, they were a good team.
Absolutely. So when they went to Cairo, basically as a couple, there was a big disparity in their ages. Emily was 48 at the time and Dorothy was 24. But they were very much a couple and in sync with each other in terms of their code breaking. And I think it was probably one of the happiest times of Emily's life was that 3 years that she spent in Cairo with Dorothy. Eventually, the relationship ended and Dorothy found another person who happened to be a male officer, and she married and had a child subsequently. But they still were professionally bound to each other and they got on with their jobs and they were able to just work in this respectful relationship, I think, until they eventually went back to Britain in 43 and went their separate ways at that stage. Although they were working in separate sections anyway, Diplo and in the case of Anderson and commercial in the case of Dorothy. It just added a little bit more colour, I suppose, and meaning to Anderson's time in Cairo. So great work being done, but at the same time, a happy time personally for her in her life.
And I think one of the most fascinating things for me in reading your book is the management at GCNCS, Denniston, and also Freddie Jacob out at CBME, completely accepting of this relationship, of the couple going out to Cairo together. And Jacob, doesn't he write back to Denniston saying, Emily and family are doing brilliantly. And
that's
there is
exactly
absolutely
right.
Zero judgment, zero disapproval.
No.
And we understand that people like Turing at Bletchley were accepted in their mirror, but the same applied to Anderson as well.
Yes, it seems to have been the case. Now, I did some work on this when I was looking at other records, and it definitely seems to have been that if you were more upper class and more important, you know, same-sex relationships were less frowned upon. In the lower orders, you know, some people had to leave Bletchley because others were given out about, you know, oh God, they're in a relationship or she's a lesbian or whatever. There are references to that in a few places.
Yes.
So it definitely seems to have been a class thing. And also in terms of your importance, if you were up the pecking order, it didn't matter what you did in your private life. Once, you know, as the saying goes, you didn't do it in the street and frighten the horses. You know, it was a case of whatever you want to do, but do your job professionally and that work. And that's what happened in the case of Anderson. Nobody ever criticised her for the fact that she had this same-sex relationship with Dorothy. They were allowed to get on with it once they proceeded to do their work, which they did spectacularly.
In the mountainous regions of Amber Alagi came the end of the war in Abyssinia. On the precipitous heights where fierce battles were fought, the last remnants of the Italian army under the Duke of Aosta capitulated. Here on the screen before you is the dramatic moment of the final surrender. Then, for the first time in this conflict, defeated enemy units are accorded honors of war. Victors honor the vanquished. The Duke of Aosta proved himself the most courageous commander we have met in the whole African campaign. And these men offered the stoutest resistance. The Duke himself insisted on being the last to leave. And his capture is a serious setback for the Italians. With the Viceroy a prisoner of war, the job of cleaning up Abyssinia is just about complete. It's a great triumph for all the Imperial forces who took part in the campaign for the liberation of a stolen empire.
So in 1943, Anderson comes back to Britain, doesn't she? And she's working at Berkeley Street in London, which is where the civil elements of GCNCS have moved.
Yes.
After the big reorganisation here in 1942. And
yes.
So she's back under Alistair Denniston.
Exactly. She's back under Denniston, who's been sort of moved sideways from Bletchley and is now in Berkeley Street. And she sees out the rest of the war there, basically working back on Diplo again. She'd been working on military when she was busy in Cairo, but now she's back doing Diplo again. And interestingly, again, she takes another swerve. So she moves from Italian. The Italians have now been dealt with, but now they need Hungarians because the Russians are coming into play. So she actually teaches herself Hungarian, one of the most difficult languages in the world to learn. Emily Anderson decides to become an expert in Hungarian. But she also, we know from some of the records we have, that she had started working on the Beethoven letters again. And there's a comment about her working on them at her desk when there was nothing else to interest her. But she just got on with it, you know, and wrote out the rest of the war and continued to stay in Berkeley Street. and maintained working within the code breaking, wherever she was asked to do and whatever she was asked to do, but particularly Hungarian codes, until she retires in 1950.
So to wrap up then, she has this incredible career that lasts decades. But what sort of recognition did Anderson actually receive during her lifetime?
The two lives, as I said at the outset, were very much separate but parallel. So we've already spoken about the fact that she gets the OBE in 1943 for her work on the East Africa campaign. I mean, the citation says for military intelligence work. So it's very specific that that's what she's doing. So she's got her OBE in the bag, and flash forward to 1961. That's the year in which her Letters of Beethoven are published. And in that year, the government of the Federal Republic of Germany decides to recognize her contribution to Beethoven's scholarship by awarding her their highest honor, which is the Order of Merit First Class. And it's presented to her in Bonn by President Heinrich Lübke. And he presents her with this award in a very fancy ceremony in this beautiful palace. Miss Anderson, Order of Merit for her work on Beethoven and Beethoven scholarship. Nobody in that room had the slightest idea that this is a woman who'd been cracking their codes since 1917. Not one of them. So the woman they're honouring had been actually listening in on their most private secret messages for over 30 years. It's astonishing. And she did it with a smile on her face.
And she didn't let on.
Not at all. I'm sure there was a sense that she must have really enjoyed it. And they would have loved her beautiful fluent German and her musicianship, etc. But no. That's why we haven't heard of Emily Anderson. She hid her secrets very, very, very well for the reasons I've outlined at the start. If she hadn't kept that code-breaking side of her life secret, she could not have been Miss Anderson, the musicologist, traveling all over Europe, meeting high-standing German officials. She just couldn't have done it, but she did.
But now we do know all about it. Emily Anderson has got the recognition she deserves because of your biography published a couple of years ago. And there's a lot in there that we haven't had a chance to cover in this episode of the podcast. So it comes highly recommended.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, she was a remarkable woman.
So that's Queen of Codes, The Secret Life of Emily Anderson, Britain's Greatest Female Codebreaker by Jackie Uchona. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.